political distinction was admitted between the Palatines and the Borderers, the troops of the court, as they were improperly styled, and the troops of the frontier. The former, elevated by the superiority of their pay and privileges, were permitted, except in the extraordinary emergencies of war, to occupy their tranquil stations in the heart of the provinces. The most flourishing cities were oppressed by the intolerable weight of quarters. The soldiers insensibly forgot the virtues of their profession and contracted only the vices of civil life. They were either degraded by the industry of mechanic trades, or enervated by the luxury of baths and theatres. They soon became careless of their martial exercises, curious in their diet and apparel, and while they inspired terror to the subjects of the empire, they trembled at the hostile approach of the barbarians. The chain of fortifications which Diocletian and his colleagues had extended along the banks of the great rivers was no longer maintained with the same care, or defended with the same vigilance. The numbers which still remained under the name of the troops of the frontier might be sufficient for the ordinary defense, but their spirit was degraded by the humiliating reflection that they who were exposed to the hardships and dangers of a perpetual warfare were rewarded only with about two-thirds of the pay and emoluments which were lavished on the troops of the court. Even the bands or legions that were raised the nearest to the level of those unworthy favorites were in some measure disgraced by the title of honor which they were allowed to assume. It was in vain that Constantine repeated the most dreadful menaces of fire and sword against the borderers who should dare desert their colors to connive at the inroads of the barbarians or to participate in the spoil. The mischiefs which flow from injudicious counsels are seldom removed by the application of partial severities, and though succeeding princes labored to restore the strength and numbers of the frontier garrisons, the empire, till the last moment of its dissolution, continued to languish under the mortal wound which had been so rashly or so weakly inflicted by the hand of Constantine. The same timid policy of dividing whatever is united, of reducing whatever is eminent, of dreading every active power, and of expecting that the most feeble will prove the most obedient, seems to pervade the institutions of several princes, and particularly those of Constantine. The martial pride of the legions, whose victorious camps had so often been the scene of rebellion, was nourished by the memory of their past exploits and the consciousness of their actual strength. As long as they maintained their ancient establishment of 6,000 men, they subsisted under the reign of Diocletian, each of them singly a visible and important object in the military history of the Roman Empire. A few years afterwards, these gigantic bodies were shrunk to a very diminutive size. And when 7 legions with some auxiliaries defended the city of Amida against the Persians, the total garrison, with the inhabitants of both sexes and the peasants of the deserted country, did not exceed the number of 20,000 persons. From this fact, and from similar examples, there is reason to believe that the constitution of the legionary troops, to which they partly owed their valor and discipline, was dissolved by Constantine, and that the bands of Roman infantry, which still assumed the same names and the same honors, consisted only of 1,000 or 1,500 men. The conspiracy of so many separate detachments, each of which was awed by the sense of its own weakness, could easily be checked. Then the successors of Constantine might indulge their love of ostentation by issuing their orders to 132 legions inscribed on the muster roll of their numerous armies. The remainder of their troops was distributed into several hundred cohorts of infantry and squadrons of cavalry. Their arms and titles and ensigns were calculated to inspire terror and to display the variety of nations who marched under the imperial standard. and not a vestige was left of that severe simplicity which, in the ages of freedom and victory, had distinguished the line of battle of a Roman army from the confused host of an Asiatic monarch. A more particular enumeration, drawn from the Notitia, might exercise the diligence of an antiquary, but the historian will content himself with observing that the number of permanent stations or garrisons established on the frontiers of the empire amounted to 583, and that under the successors of Constantine, the complete force of the military establishment was computed at 645,000 soldiers. An effort so prodigious surpassed the wants of a more ancient and the faculties of a later period. In the various states of society, armies are recruited from very different motives. Barbarians are urged by the love of war. The citizen of a free republic may be prompted by a principle of duty. The subjects, or at least the nobles of a monarchy, are animated by a sentiment of honor. But the timid and luxurious inhabitants of a declining empire must be allured into the service by the hopes of profit, or compelled by the dread of punishment. The resources of the Roman treasury were exhausted by the increase of pay, by the repetition of donatives, and by the invention of new emolument and indulgences, which, in the opinion of the provincial youth, might compensate the hardships and dangers of a military life. Yet although the stature was lowered, although slaves, leased by a tacit connivance, were indiscriminately received into the ranks, the insurmountable difficulty of procuring a regular and adequate supply of volunteers obliged the emperors to adopt more effectual and coercive methods. The lands bestowed on the veterans, as the free reward of their valor, were henceforward granted under a condition which contained the first rudiments of the feudal tenures, that their sons, who succeeded to the inheritance, should devote themselves to the profession of arms as soon as they attained the age of manhood, and their cowardly refusal was punished by the loss of honor, of fortune, or even of life. But as the annual growth of the sons of the veterans bore a very small proportion to the demands of the service, levies of men were frequently required from the provinces, and every proprietor was obliged either to take up arms or to procure a substitute, or to purchase his exemption by the payment of a heavy fine. The sum of 42 pieces of gold to which it was reduced ascertains the exorbitant price of volunteers, and the reluctance with which the government admitted of this alternative. Such was the horror for the profession of a soldier which had affected the minds of the degenerate Romans that many of the youth of Italy and the provinces chose to cut off the fingers of their right hand to escape from being pressed into the service. And this strange expedient was so commonly practiced as to deserve the severe animadversion of the laws and a peculiar name in the Latin language. The introduction of barbarians into the Roman armies became every day more universal, more necessary, and more fatal. The most daring of the Scythians, of the Goths, and of the Germans, who delighted in war, and who found it more profitable to defend than to ravage the provinces, were enrolled, not only in the auxiliaries of their respective nations, but in the legions themselves, and among the most distinguished of the Palatine troops. As they freely mingled with the subjects of the empire, they gradually learned to despise their manners and to imitate their arts. They abjured the implicit reverence which the pride of Rome had exacted from their ignorance, while they acquired the knowledge and possession of those advantages by which alone she supported her declining greatness. The barbarian soldiers who displayed any military talents were advanced, without exception, to the most important commands. Then the names of the tribunes, of the counts and dukes, and of the generals themselves betray a foreign origin which they no longer condescended to disguise. They were often interested with the conduct of a war against their countrymen, and though most of them preferred the ties of allegiance to those of blood, they did not always avoid the guilt, or at least the suspicion, of holding a treasonable correspondence with the enemy, of inviting his invasion, or of sparing his retreat. The camps and the palace of the son of Constantine were governed by the powerful faction of the Franks, who preserved the strictest connection with each other and with their country, and who resented every personal affront as a national indignity. When the tyrant Caligula was suspected of an intention to invest a very extraordinary candidate with the consular robes, the sacrilegious profanation would have scarcely excited less astonishment if, instead of a horse, the noblest chieftain of Germany or Britain had been the object of his choice. The revolution of three centuries had produced so remarkable a change in the prejudices of the people that, with the public approbation, Constantine showed his successors the example of bestowing the honors of the consulship on the barbarians, who, by their merit and services, had deserved to be ranked among the first of the Romans. But as these hardy veterans, who had been educated in the ignorance or contempt of the laws, were incapable of exercising any civil offices, the powers of the human mind were contracted by the irreconcilable separation of talents as well as of professions. The accomplished citizens of the Greek and Roman republics, whose characters could adapt themselves to the bar, the senate, the camp, or the schools, had learned to write, to speak, and to act with the same spirit, and with equal abilities. Besides the magistrates and generals who, at a distance from the court, diffused their delegated authority over the provinces and armies, the emperor conferred the rank of illustrious on seven of his more immediate servants, to whose fidelity he entrusted his safety or his counsels, or his treasures. The private apartments of the palace were governed by a favorite eunuch, who in the language of that age was styled the prepositus, or prefect of the sacred bedchamber. His duty was to attend the emperor in his hours of state, or in those of amusement, and to perform about his person all those menial services which can only derive their splendor from the influence of royalty. Under a prince who deserved to reign, the great chamberlain, for such we may call him, was a useful and humble domestic, but an artful domestic who improves every occasion of unguarded confidence will insensibly acquire over a feeble mind that ascendant which harsh wisdom and uncomplying virtue can seldom obtain. The degenerate grandsons of Theodosius, who were invisible to their subjects and contemptible to their enemies, exalted the prefects of their bedchamber above the heads of all the ministers of the palace, and even his deputy, the first of the splendid train of slaves who waited in the presence, was thought worthy to rank before the respectable proconsuls of Greece or Asia. The jurisdiction of the chamberlain was acknowledged by the counts or superintendents, who regulated the two important provinces of the magnificence of the wardrobe and of the luxury of the imperial table. The principal administration of public affairs was committed to the diligence and abilities of the master of the offices. He was the supreme magistrate of the palace, inspected the discipline of the civil and military schools, and received appeals from all parts of the empire. Then the causes which related to that numerous army of privileged persons who, as the servants of the court, had obtained for themselves and families a right to decline the authority of the ordinary judges. The correspondence between the prince and his subjects was managed by the four scrinia, or offices of this minister of state. The first was appropriated to memorials, the second to epistles, the third to petitions, and the fourth to papers and orders of a miscellaneous kind. Each of these was directed by an inferior master of respectable dignity, and the whole business was dispatched by 148 secretaries, chosen for the most part from the profession of the law, on account of the variety of abstracts of reports and references which frequently occurred in the exercise of their several functions. From a condescension which in former ages would have been esteemed unworthy the Roman majesty, a particular secretary was allowed for the Greek language, and the interpreters were appointed to receive the ambassadors of the barbarians. But the Department of Foreign Affairs, which constitutes so essential a part of modern policy, seldom diverted the attention of the master of the offices. His mind was more seriously engaged by the general direction of the posts and arsenals of the empire. There were 34 cities, 15 in the east and 19 in the west, in which regular companies of workmen were perpetually employed in fabricating defensive armor, offensive weapons of all sorts, and military engines, which were deposited in the arsenals and occasionally delivered for the service of the troops. In the course of 9 centuries, the office of quaestor had experienced a very singular revolution. In the infancy of Rome, 2 inferior magistrates were annually elected by the people to relieve the consuls from the invidious management of the public treasure. A similar assistance was granted to every proconsul and to every praetor who exercised a military or provincial command. With the extent of conquest, the 2 quaestors were gradually multiplied to the number of 4, of 8, of 20, and for a short time perhaps of 40. Then the noblest citizens ambitiously solicited an office which gave them a seat in the Senate, and a just hope of obtaining the honors of the Republic. While Augustus affected to maintain the freedom of election, he consented to accept the annual privilege of recommending, or rather, indeed, of nominating a certain proportion of candidates, and it was his custom to select one of these distinguished youths to read his orations or epistles in the assemblies of the Senate. The practice of Augustus was imitated by succeeding princes. The occasional commission was established as a permanent office, and the favored quaestor, assuming a new and more illustrious character, alone survived the suppression of his ancient and useless colleagues. As the orations which he composed in the name of the emperor acquired the force and at length the form of absolute edicts, he was considered as the representative of the legislative power, the oracle of the council, and the original source of the civil jurisprudence. He was sometimes invited to take his seat in the supreme judicature of the imperial consistory, with the praetorian prefects and the master of the offices, and he was frequently requested to resolve the doubts of inferior judges. But as he was not oppressed with a variety of subordinate business, his leisure and talents were employed to cultivate that dignified style of eloquence which, in the corruption of taste and language, still preserves the majesty of the Roman laws. In some respects, the office of the imperial quaestor may be compared with that of a modern chancellor, but the use of a great seal, which seems to have been adopted by the illiterate barbarians, was never introduced to attest the public acts of the emperors. The extraordinary title of Count of the Sacred Largesses was bestowed on the Treasurer General of the Revenue, with the intention, perhaps, of inculcating that every payment flowed from the voluntary bounty of the monarch. To conceive the almost infinite detail of the annual and daily expense of the civil and military administration in every part of a great empire would exceed the powers of the most vigorous imagination. The actual account employed several hundred persons, distributed into 11 different offices, which were artfully contrived to examine and control their respective operations. The multitude of these agents had a natural tendency to increase. And it was more than once thought expedient to dismiss to their native homes the useless supernumeraries, who, deserting their honest labors, had pressed with too much eagerness into the lucrative profession of their finances. 29 provincial receivers, of whom 18 were honored with the title of Count, corresponded with the treasurer, and he extended his jurisdiction over the mines from whence the precious metals were extracted, over the mints in which they were converted into the current coin, and over the public treasuries of the most important cities, where they were deposited for the service of the state. The foreign trade of the empire was regulated by this minister, who directed likewise all the linen and woolen manufactures in which the successive operations of spinning, weaving, and dyeing were executed, chiefly by women of a servile condition for the use of the palace and army. 26 of these institutions are enumerated in the West, where they are to be more recently introduced, and a still larger proportion may be allowed for the industrious provinces of the East. Besides the public revenue, which an absolute monarch might levy and expend according to his pleasure, the emperors, in the capacity of opulent citizens, possessed a very extensive property, which was administered by the count or treasurer of the private estate. Some part had perhaps been the ancient domains of kings and republics. Some accessions might be derived from the families which were successively invested with the purple. But the most considerable portion flowed from the impure source of confiscations and forfeitures. The imperial estates were scattered through the provinces from Mauritania to Britain, but the rich and fertile soil of Cappadocia tempted the monarch to acquire in that country his fairest possessions, and either Constantine or his successors embraced the occasion of justifying avarice by religious zeal. They suppressed the rich temple of Cumana, where the high priest of the goddess of war supported the dignity of a sovereign prince, and they apply to their private use the consecrated lands which were inhabited by 6,000 subjects or slaves of the deity and her ministers. But these were not the valuable inhabitants. The plains that stretched from the foot of Mount Argeus to the banks of the Sorus bred a generous race of horses, renowned above all others in the ancient world for their majestic shape and incomparable swiftness. These sacred animals, destined for the service of the palace and the imperial games, were protected by the laws from the profanation of a vulgar master. The domains of Cappadocia were important enough to require the inspection of a count. Officers of an inferior rank were stationed in the other parts of the empire, and the deputies of the private, as well as those of the public treasurer, were maintained in the exercise of their independent functions, and encouraged to control the authority of the provincial magistrates. The chosen bands of cavalry and infantry which guarded the person of the emperor were under the immediate command of the two counts of the domestics. The whole number consisted of 3,500 men, divided into 7 schools, or troops, of 500 each, and in the East this honorable service was almost entirely appropriated to the Armenians. Whenever, on public ceremonies, they were drawn up in the courts and porticos of the palace, their lofty stature, silent order, and splendid arms of silver and gold displayed a martial pomp not unworthy of the Roman majesty. From the 7 schools, 2 companies of horse and foot were selected of the protectors, whose advantageous station was the hope and reward of the most deserving soldiers. They mounted guard in the interior apartments and were occasionally dispatched into the provinces to execute with celerity and vigor the orders of their master. The counts of the domestics had succeeded to the office of the Praetorian prefects. Like the prefects, they aspired from the service of the palace to the command of armies. The perpetual intercourse between the court and the provinces was facilitated by the construction of roads and the institution of posts. But these beneficial establishments were accidentally connected with a pernicious and intolerable abuse. 200 or 300 agents or messengers were employed under the jurisdiction of the master of the offices to announce the names of the annual consuls and the edicts or victories of the emperors. They insensibly assumed the license of reporting whatever they could observe of the conduct either of magistrates or of private citizens, and were soon considered as the eyes of the monarch and the scourge of the people. Under the warm influence of a feeble reign, they multiplied to the incredible number of 10,000, disdained the mild, though frequent, admonitions of the laws, and exercised in the profitable management of the posts a rapacious and insolent oppression. These official spies, who regularly corresponded with the palace, were encouraged by favor and reward anxiously to watch the progress of every treasonable design, from the faint and latent symptoms of disaffection to the actual preparation of an open revolt. Their careless or criminal violation of truth and justice was covered by the consecrated mask of zeal, and they might securely aim their poisoned arrows at the breast either of the guilty or the innocent, who had provoked their resentment or refused to purchase their silence. A faithful subject of Syria, perhaps, or of Britain, was exposed to the danger, or at least to the dread, of being dragged in chains to the court of Milan or Constantinople to defend his life and fortune against the malicious charge of these privileged informers. The ordinary administration was conducted by those methods which extreme necessity can alone palliate, and the defects of evidence were diligently supplied by the use of torture. The deceitful and dangerous experiment of the criminal question, as it is emphatically styled, was admitted, rather than approved, in the jurisprudence of the Romans. They applied this sanguinary mode of examination only to servile bodies, whose sufferings were seldom weighed by those haughty republicans in the scale of justice or humanity. But they would never consent to violate the sacred person of a citizen till they possessed the clearest evidence of his guilt. The annals of tyranny, from the reign of Tiberius to that of Domitian, circumstantially relate the executions of many innocent victims. But as long as the faintest remembrance was kept alive of the national freedom and honor, the last hours of a Roman were secured from the danger of ignominious torture. The conduct of the provincial magistrates was not, however, regulated by the practice of the city or the strict maxims of the civilians. They found the use of torture established not only among the slaves of Oriental despotism, but among the Macedonians, who obeyed a limited monarch, among the Rhodians, who flourished by the liberty of commerce, and even among the sage Athenians, who had asserted and adorned the dignity of humankind. The acquiescence of the provincials encouraged their governors to acquire, or perhaps to usurp, a discretionary power of employing the rack to extort from vagrants or plebeian criminals the confession of their guilt till they insensibly proceeded to confound the distinction of rank and to disregard the privileges of Roman citizens. The apprehensions of the subject urged them to solicit, and the interest of the sovereign engaged him to grant a variety of special exemptions, which tacitly allowed and even authorized the general use of torture. They protected all persons of illustrious or honorable rank, bishops and their praestors, professors of the liberal arts, soldiers and their families, municipal officers and their posterity to the third generation, and all children under the age of puberty. But a fatal maxim was introduced into the new jurisprudence of the empire, that in the case of treason, which included every offence against the subtlety of lawyers, could derive from a hostile intention towards the prince or republic, all privileges were suspended, and all conditions were reduced to the same ignominious level. As the safety of the Emperor was avowedly preferred to every consideration of justice or humanity, the dignity of age and the tenderness of youth were alike exposed to the most cruel tortures, and the terrors of a malicious information which might select them as the accomplices, or even as the witnesses, perhaps, of an imaginary crime, perpetually hung over the heads of the principal citizens of the Roman world. These evils, however terrible they may appear, were confined to the smaller number of Roman subjects whose dangerous situation was in some degree compensated by the enjoyment of those advantages, either of nature or of fortune, which exposed them to the jealousy of the monarch. The obscure millions of a great empire have much less to dread from the cruelty than from the avarice of their masters, and their humble happiness is principally affected by the grievance of excessive taxes, which, gently pressing on the wealthy, descend with accelerated weight on the meaner and more indigent classes of society. An ingenious philosopher has calculated the universal measure of the public impositions by the degrees of freedom and servitude, and ventures to assert that according to an invariable law of nature, it must always increase with the former and diminish in a just proportion to the latter. But this reflection, which would tend to alleviate the miseries of despotism, is contradicted at least by the history of the Roman Empire, which accuses the same princes of despoiling the Senate of its authority and the provinces of their wealth. Without abolishing all the various customs and duties on merchandises which are imperceptibly discharged by the apparent choice of the purchaser, the policy of Constantine and his successors preferred a simple and direct mode of taxation, more congenial to the spirit of an arbitrary government. The name and use of the indictions which serve to ascertain the chronology of the Middle Ages were derived from the regular practice of the Roman tributes. The emperor subscribed with his own hand, and in purple ink, the solemn edict, or indiction, which was fixed up in the principal city of each diocese during 2 months previous to the first day of September. And by a very easy connection of ideas, the word indiction was transferred to the measure of tribute which it prescribed, and to the annual term which it allowed for the payment. The general estimate of the supplies was proportioned to the real and imaginary wants of the state, but as often as the expense exceeded the revenue, or the revenue fell short of the computation, an additional tax under the name of superindiction was imposed on the people, and the most valuable attribute of sovereignty was communicated to the praetorian prefects, who on the same occasions were permitted to provide for the unforeseen and extraordinary exigencies of the public service. The execution of these laws, which it would be tedious to pursue in their minute and intricate detail, consisted of two distinct operations. The resolving of the general imposition into its constituent parts, which were assessed on the provinces, the cities, and the individuals of the Roman world, and the collecting the separate contributions of the individuals, the cities, and the provinces, till the accumulated sums were poured into the imperial treasuries. But as the account between the monarch and the subject was perpetually open, and as the renewal of the demand anticipated the perfect discharge of the preceding obligation, the weighty machine of the finances was moved by the same hands round the circle of its yearly revolution. Whatever was honorable or important in the administration of the revenue was committed to the wisdom of the prefects and their provincial representatives. The lucrative functions were claimed by a crowd of subordinate officers, some of whom depended on the treasurer, others on the governor of the province, and who, in the inevitable conflicts of a perplexed jurisdiction, had frequent opportunities of disputing with each other the spoils of the people. The laborious offices, which could be productive only of envy and reproach, of expense and danger, were imposed on the decurions, who formed the corporations of the cities, and whom the severity of the imperial laws had condemned to sustain the burdens of civil society. The whole landed property of the empire, without excepting the patrimonial estates of the monarch, was the object of ordinary taxation, and every new purchaser contracted the obligations of the former proprietor. An accurate census or survey was the only equitable mode of ascertaining the proportion which every citizen should be obliged to contribute for the public service. And from the well-known period of the indictions, there is reason to believe that this difficult and expensive operation was repeated at the regular distance of 15 years. The lands were measured by surveyors who were sent into the provinces. Their nature, whether arable or pasture, or vineyards or woods, was distinctly reported, and an estimate was made of their common value from the average produce of 5 years. The numbers of slaves and of cattle constituted an essential part of the report. An oath was administered to the proprietors which bound them to disclose the true state of their affairs, and their attempts to prevaricate or elude the intention of the legislator were severely watched and punished as a capital crime, which included the double guilt of treason and sacrilege. A large portion of the tribute was paid in money, and of the current coin of the empire, gold alone could be legally accepted. The remainder of the taxes, according to the proportions determined by the annual indiction, was furnished in a manner still more direct and still more oppressive. According to the different nature of lands, their real produce in the various articles of wine or oil, corn or barley, wood or iron, was transported by the labor or at the expense of the provincials to the imperial magazines, from whence they were occasionally distributed for the use of the court, of the army, and of two capitals, Rome and Constantinople. The commissioners of the revenue were so frequently obliged to make considerable purchases that they were strictly prohibited from allowing any compensation or from receiving in money the value of those supplies which were exacted in kind. In the primitive simplicity of small communities, this method may be well adapted to collect the almost voluntary offerings of the people. But it is at once susceptible of the utmost latitude and of the utmost strictness, which in a corrupt and absolute monarchy must introduce a perpetual contest between the power of oppression and the arts of fraud. The agriculture of the Roman provinces was insensibly ruined, and in the progress of despotism, which tends to disappoint its own purpose, the emperors were obliged to derive some merit from the forgiveness of debts, or the remission of tributes, which their subjects were utterly incapable of paying. According to the new division of Italy, the fertile and happy province of Campania, the scene of the early victories and of the delicious retirements of the citizens of Rome, extended between the sea and the Apennine, from the Tiber to the Selarus. Within 60 years after the death of Constantine, and on the evidence of an actual survey, an exemption was granted in favor of 330,000 English acres of desert and uncultivated land, which amounted to 1/8 of the whole surface of the province. As the footsteps of the barbarians had not yet been seen in Italy, the cause of this amazing desolation, which is recorded in the laws, can be ascribed only to the administration of the Roman emperors. Either from design or from accident, the mode of assessment seemed to unite the substance of a land tax with the forms of a capitation. The returns which were sent of every province or district expressed the number of tributary subjects and the amount of the public impositions. The latter of these sums was divided by the former, and the estimate that such a province contained so many capita or heads of tribute, and that each head was rated at such a price, was universally received, not only in the popular, but even in the legal computation. The value of a tributary head must have varied according to many accidental or at least fluctuating circumstances. But some knowledge has been preserved of a very curious fact, the more important since it relates to one of the richest provinces of the Roman Empire, and which now flourishes as the most splendid of the European kingdoms. The rapacious ministers of Constantius had exhausted the wealth of Gaul by exacting 25 pieces of gold for the annual tribute of every head. The humane policy of his successor reduced the capitation to 7 pieces. A moderate proportion between these opposite extremes of extraordinary oppression and of transient indulgence may therefore be fixed at 16 pieces of gold, or about £9 sterling, the common standard, perhaps, of the impositions of Gaul. But this calculation, or rather, indeed, the facts from whence it is deduced, cannot fail of suggesting 2 difficulties to a thinking mind, who will at once be surprised by the equality and by the enormity of the capitation. An attempt to explain them may perhaps reflect some light on the interesting subject of the finances of the declining empire. It is obvious that as long as the immutable constitution of human nature produces and maintains so unequal a division of property, the most numerous part of the community would be deprived of their subsistence by the equal assessment of a tax from which the sovereign would derive a very trifling revenue. Such indeed might be the theory of the Roman capitation. But in the practice, this unjust equality was no longer felt, as the tribute was collected on the principle of a real, not of a personal imposition. Several indigent citizens contributed to compose a single head, or share, of taxation. While the wealthy provincial, in proportion to his fortune, alone represented several of those imaginary beings. In a poetical request addressed to one of the last and most deserving of the Roman princes who reigned in Gaul, Sidonius Apollinaris personifies his tribute under the figure of a triple monster, the Geryon of the Grecian fables, and entreats the new Hercules that he would most graciously be pleased to save his life by cutting off 3 of his heads. The fortune of Sidonius far exceeded the customary wealth of a poet, but if he had pursued the illusion, he might have painted many of the Gallic nobles with the 100 heads of the deadly Hydra spreading over the face of the country and devouring the substance of 100 families. The difficulty of allowing an annual sum of about £9 sterling, even for the average of the capitation of Gaul, may be rendered more evident by the comparison of the present state of the same country, as it is now governed by the absolute monarch of an industrious, wealthy, and affectionate people. The taxes of France cannot be magnified, either by fear or by flattery, beyond the annual amount of 18 millions sterling, which ought, perhaps, to be shared among 24 millions of inhabitants. 7 millions of these, in the capacity of fathers or brothers or husbands, may discharge the obligations of the remaining multitude of women and children. Yet the equal proportion of each tributary subject will scarcely rise above 50 shillings of our money, instead of a proportion almost 4 times as considerable, which was regularly imposed on their Gallic ancestors. The reason of this difference may be found not so much in the relative scarcity or plenty of gold and silver, as in the different state of society in ancient Gaul and in modern France. In a country where personal freedom is the privilege of every subject, the whole mass of taxes, whether they are levied on property or on consumption, may be fairly divided among the whole body of the nation. But the far greater part of the lands of ancient Gaul, as well as of the other provinces of the Roman world, were cultivated by slaves or by peasants, whose dependent condition was a less rigid servitude. In such a state, the poor were maintained at the expense of the masters, who enjoyed the fruits of their labor. And as the rolls of tribute were filled only with the names of those citizens who possessed the means of an honorable or at least of a decent subsistence, the comparative smallness of their numbers explains and justifies the high rate of their capitation. The truth of this assertion may be illustrated by the following example. The Aedui, one of the most powerful and civilized tribes or cities of Gaul, occupied an extent of territory which now contains about 500,000 inhabitants in the 2 ecclesiastical dioceses of Autun and Nevers. And with the probable accession of those of Chalon and Mecon, the population would amount to 800,000 souls. In the time of Constantine, the territory of the Aedui afforded no more than 25,000 heads of capitation, of whom 7,000 were discharged by that prince from the intolerable weight of tribute. A just analogy would seem to countenance the opinion of an ingenious historian that the free and tributary citizens did not surpass the number of 500,000. And if, in the ordinary administration of government, their annual payments may be computed at about 4.5 millions of our money, it would appear that although the share of each individual was four times as considerable, a fourth part only of the modern taxes of France was levied on the imperial province of Gaul. The exactions of Constantius may be calculated at 7 millions sterling, which were reduced to 2 millions by the humanity or the wisdom of Julian. But this tax or capitation on the proprietors of land would have suffered a rich and numerous class of free citizens to escape. With the view of sharing that species of wealth which is derived from art or labor, and which exists in money or in merchandise, the emperors imposed a distinct and personal tribute on the trading part of their subjects. Some exemptions, very strictly confined, both in time and place, were allowed the proprietors who disposed of the produce of their own estates. Some indulgence was granted to the profession of the liberal arts, but every other branch of commercial industry was affected by the severity of the law. The honorable merchant of Alexandria, who imported the gems and spices of India for the use of the Western world, the usurer, who derived from the interest of money a silent and ignominious profit, the ingenious manufacturer, the diligent mechanic, and even the most obscure retailer of a sequestered village, were obliged to admit the officers of the revenue into the partnership of their gain. And the sovereign of the Roman Empire, who tolerated the profession, consented to share the infamous salary of public prostitutes. As this general tax upon industry was collected every fourth year, it was styled the lustral contribution. And the historian Zosimus laments that the approach of the fatal period was announced by the tears and terrors of the citizens, who were often compelled by the impending scourge to embrace the most abhorred and unnatural methods of procuring the sum at which their property had been assessed. The testimony of Zosimus cannot indeed be justified from the charge of passion and prejudice, but from the nature of this tribute it seems reasonable to conclude that it was arbitrary in the distribution and extremely rigorous in the mode of collecting. The secret wealth of commerce and the precarious profits of art or labor are susceptible only of a discretionary valuation which is seldom advantageous to the interest of the treasury, and as the person of the trader supplies the want of a visible and permanent security, the payment of the imposition, which in the case of a land tax may be obtained by the seizure of property, can rarely be extorted by any other means than those of corporal punishments. The cruel treatment of the insolvent debtors of the state is attested, and was perhaps mitigated, by a very humane edict of Constantine, who, disclaiming the use of racks and of scourges, allots a spacious and airy prison for the place of their confinement. These general taxes were imposed and levied by the absolute authority of the monarch, but the occasional offerings of the coronary gold still retained the name and semblance of popular consent. It was an ancient custom that the allies of the Republic, who ascribed their safety or deliverance to the success of the Roman arms, and even the cities of Italy, who admired the virtues of their victorious general, adorned the pomp of his triumph by their voluntary gifts of crowns of gold, which, after the ceremony, were consecrated in the temple of Jupiter to retain a lasting monument of his glory to future ages. The progressive zeal and flattery soon multiplied the number and increased the size of these popular donations, and the triumph of Caesar was enriched with 2,822 massy crowns, whose weight amounted to 20,414 pounds of gold. This treasure was immediately melted down by the prudent dictator, who was satisfied that it would be more serviceable to his soldiers than to the gods. His example was imitated by his successors, and the custom was introduced of exchanging these splendid ornaments for the more acceptable present of the current gold coin of the empire. The spontaneous offering was at length exacted as the debt of duty, and instead of being confined to the occasion of a triumph, it was supposed to be granted by the several cities and provinces of the monarchy as often as the emperor condescended to announce his accession, his consulship, the birth of a son, the creation of a Caesar, a victory over the barbarians, or any other real or imaginary event which graced the annals of his reign. The peculiar free gift of the Senate of Rome was fixed by custom at 1,600 pounds of gold, or about 64,000 pounds sterling. The oppressed subjects celebrated their own felicity that their sovereign should graciously consent to accept this feeble but voluntary testimony of their loyalty and gratitude. A people elated by pride or soured by discontent are seldom qualified to form a just estimate of their actual situation. The subjects of Constantine were incapable of discerning the decline of genius and manly virtue, which so far degraded them below the dignity of their ancestors. But they could feel and lament the rage of tyranny, the relaxation of discipline, and the increase of taxes. The impartial historian, who acknowledges the justice of their complaints, will observe some favorable circumstances which tended to alleviate the misery of their condition. The threatening tempest of barbarians, which so soon subverted the foundations of Roman greatness, was still repelled or suspended on the frontiers. The arts of luxury and literature were cultivated, and the elegant pleasures of society were enjoyed by the inhabitants of a considerable portion of the globe. The forms, the pomp, and the expense of the civil administration contributed to restrain the irregular license of the soldiers, and although the laws were violated by power or perverted by subtlety, the sage principles of the Roman jurisprudence preserved a sense of order and equity unknown to the despotic governments of the East. The rights of mankind might derive some protection from religion and philosophy, and the name of freedom, which could no longer alarm, might sometimes admonish the successors of Augustus that they did not reign over a nation of slaves or barbarians. Chapter 18. Character of Constantine. Gothic War. Death of Constantine. Division of the empire among his three sons. Persian War. Tragic deaths of Constantine the Younger and Constans. Usurpation of Magnentius. Civil War. Victory of Constantius. The character of the prince who removed the seat of empire and introduced such important changes into the civil and religious constitution of his country has fixed the attention and divided the opinions of mankind. By the grateful zeal of the Christians, the deliverer of the church has been decorated with every attribute of a hero, and even of a saint, while the discontent of the vanquished party has compared Constantine to the most abhorred of those tyrants who, by their vice and weakness, dishonored the imperial purple. The same passions have in some degree been perpetuated to succeeding generations, and the character of Constantine is considered, even in the present age, as an object either of satire or of panegyric. By the impartial union of those defects which are confessed by his warmest admirers, and of those virtues which are acknowledged by his most implacable enemies, we might hope to delineate a just portrait of that extraordinary man, which the truth and candor of history should adopt without a blush. But it would soon appear that the vain attempt to blend such discordant colors and to reconcile such inconsistent qualities must produce a figure monstrous rather than human, unless it is viewed in its proper and distinct lights by careful separation of the different periods of the reign of Constantine. The person as well as the mind of Constantine had been enriched by nature with her choicest endowments. His stature was lofty, his countenance majestic, his deportment graceful. His strength and activity were displayed in every manly exercise, and from his earliest youth to a very advanced season of life, he preserved the vigor of his constitution by strict adherence to the domestic virtues of chastity and temperance. He delighted in the social intercourse of familiar conversation, and though he might sometimes indulge his disposition to raillery with less reserve than was required by the severe dignity of his station, the courtesy and liberality of his manners gained the hearts of all who approached him. The sincerity of his friendship has been suspected, yet he showed on some occasions that he was not incapable of a warm and lasting attachment. The disadvantage of an illiterate education had not prevented him from forming a just estimate of the value of learning, and the arts and sciences derived some encouragement from the munificent protection of Constantine. In the dispatch of business, his diligence was indefatigable, and the active powers of his mind were almost continually exercised in reading, writing, or meditating, in giving audiences to ambassadors, and in examining the complaints of his subjects. Even those who censured the propriety of his measures were compelled to acknowledge that he possessed magnanimity to conceive and patience to execute the most arduous designs without being checked either by the prejudices of education or by the clamors of the multitude. In the field, he infused his own intrepid spirit into the troops whom he conducted with the talents of a consummate general. And to his abilities, rather than to his fortune, we may ascribe the signal victories which he obtained over the foreign and domestic foes of the Republic. He loved glory as the reward, perhaps as the motive, of his labors. The boundless ambition which, from the moment of his accepting the purple at York, appears as the ruling passion of his soul, may be justified by the dangers of his own situation, by the character of his rivals, by the consciousness of superior merit, and by the prospect that his success would enable him to restore peace and order to the distracted empire. In his civil wars against Maxentius and Licinius, he had engaged on his side the inclination of the people, who compared the undissembled vices of those tyrants with the spirit of wisdom and justice which seemed to direct the general tenor of the administration of Constantine. Had Constantine fallen on the banks of the Tiber, or even in the plains of Hadrianople, such is the character which, with a few exceptions, he might have transmitted to posterity. But the conclusion of his reign, according to the moderate and indeed tender sentence of a writer of the same age, degraded him from the rank which he had acquired among the most deserving of the Roman princes. In the life of Augustus we behold the tyrant of the Republic, converted almost by imperceptible degrees into the father of his country and of humankind. In that of Constantine, we may contemplate a hero who had so long inspired his subjects with love, and his enemies with terror, degenerating into a cruel and dissolute monarch, corrupted by his fortune, or raised by conquest above the necessity of dissimulation. The general peace which he maintained during the last 14 years of his reign was a period of apparent splendor, rather than of real prosperity. And the old age of Constantine was disgraced by the opposite yet reconcilable vices of rapaciousness and prodigality. The accumulated treasures found in the palaces of Maxentius and Licinius were lavishly consumed. The various innovations introduced by the conqueror were attended with an increasing expense. The cost of his buildings, his court, and his festivals required an immediate and plentiful supply. And the oppression of the people was the only fund which could support the magnificence of the sovereign. His unworthy favorites, enriched by the boundless liberality of their master, usurped with impunity the privilege of rapine and corruption. A secret but universal decay was felt in every part of the public administration, and the emperor himself, though he still retained the obedience, gradually lost the esteem of his subjects. The dress and manners which, towards the decline of life, he chose to affect, served only to degrade him in the eyes of mankind. The Asiatic pomp, which had been adopted by the pride of Diocletian, assumed an air of softness and effeminacy in the person of Constantine. He is represented with false hair of various colours, laboriously arranged by the skilful artists to the times. A diadem of a new and more expensive fashion, a profusion of gems and pearls, of collars and bracelets, and a variegated flowing robe of silk, most curiously embroidered with flowers of gold. In such apparel, scarcely to be excused by the youth and folly of Elagabalus, we are at a loss to discover the wisdom of an aged monarch and the simplicity of a Roman veteran. A mind thus relaxed by prosperity and indulgence was incapable of rising to that magnanimity which disdains suspicion and dares to forgive. The deaths of Maximian and Licinius may perhaps be justified by the maxims of policy, as they are taught in the schools of tyrants. But an impartial narrative of the executions, or rather murders, which sullied the declining age of Constantine, will suggest to our most candid thoughts the idea of a prince who could sacrifice, without reluctance, the laws of justice and the feelings of nature to the dictates either of his passions or of his interest. The same fortune which so invariably followed the standard of Constantine seemed to secure the hopes and comforts of his domestic life. Those among his predecessors who had enjoyed the longest and most prosperous reigns, Augustus, Trajan, and Diocletian, had been disappointed of posterity, and the frequent revolutions had never allowed sufficient time for any imperial family to grow up and multiply under the shade of the purple. But the royalty of the Flavian line, which had been first ennobled by the Gothic Claudius, descended through several generations, and Constantine himself derived from his royal father the hereditary honors which he transmitted to his children. The emperor had been twice married. Minerva, the obscure but lawful object of his youthful attachment, had left him only one son, who was called Crispus. By Fausta, the daughter of Maximian, he had three daughters and three sons, known by the kindred names of Constantine, Constantius, and Constans. The unambitious brothers of the great Constantine, Julius Constantius, Dalmatius, and Hannibalianus, were permitted to enjoy the most honorable rank and the most affluent fortune that could be consistent with a private station. The youngest of the three lived without a name and died without posterity. His two elder brothers obtained in marriage the daughters of wealthy senators and propagated new branches of the imperial race. Gallus and Julian afterwards became the most illustrious of the children of Julius Constantius, the patrician. The two sons of Domitius, who had been decorated with the vain title of censor, were named Dalmatius and Hannibalianus. The two sisters of the great Constantine, Anastasia and Eutropia, were bestowed on Optatus and Nepotianus, two senators of noble birth and of consular dignity. His third sister, Constantia, was distinguished by her preeminence of greatness and of misery. She remained the widow of the vanquished Licinius, and it was by her entreaties that an innocent boy, the offspring of their marriage, preserved for some time his life, the title of Caesar, and a precarious hope of the succession. Besides the females and the allies of the Flavian house, 10 or 12 males, to whom the language of modern courts would apply the title of princes of the blood, seemed, according to the order of their birth, to be destined either to inherit or to support the throne of Constantine. But in less than 30 years this numerous and increasing family was reduced to the persons of Constantius and Julian, who alone had survived a series of crimes and calamities, such as the tragic poets have deplored in the devoted lines of Pelops and of Cadmus. Crispus, the eldest son of Constantine and the presumptive heir of the empire, is represented by impartial historians as an amiable and accomplished youth. The care of his education, or at least of his studies, was entrusted to Lactantius, the most eloquent of the Christians, a preceptor admirably qualified to form the taste and excite the virtues of his illustrious disciple. At the age of 17, Crispus was invested with the title of Caesar, and the administration of the Gallic provinces, where the inroads of the Germans gave him an early occasion of signalizing his military prowess. In the civil war which broke out soon afterwards, the father and son divided their powers, and this history has already celebrated the valor as well as conduct displayed by the latter in forcing the straits of the Hellespont, so obstinately defended by the superior fleet of Licinius. This naval victory contributed to determine the event of the war, and the names of Constantine and of Crispus were united in the joyful acclamations of their eastern subjects, who loudly proclaimed that the world had been subdued and was now governed by an emperor endowed with every virtue, and by his illustrious son, a prince beloved of heaven, and the lively image of his father's perfections. The public favor, which seldom accompanies old age, diffused its luster over the youth of Crispus. He deserved the esteem, and he engaged the affections of the court, the army, and the people. The experienced merit of a reigning monarch is acknowledged by his subjects, with reluctance, and frequently denied with partial and discontented murmurs, while from the opening virtues of his successor they fondly conceive the most unbounded hopes of private as well as public felicity. This dangerous popularity soon excited the attention of Constantine, who, both as a father and as a king, was impatient of an equal. Instead of attempting to secure the allegiance of his son by the generous ties of confidence and gratitude, he resolved to prevent the mischiefs which might be apprehended from dissatisfied ambition. Crispus soon had reason to complain that while his infant brother Constantius was sent with the title of Caesar to reign over his peculiar department of the Gallic provinces, he, a prince of mature years, who had performed such recent and signal services, instead of being raised to the superior rank of Augustus, was confined, almost a prisoner, to his father's court, and exposed, without power or defense, to every calumny which the malice of his enemies could suggest. Under such painful circumstances, the royal youth might not always be able to compose his behavior or suppress his discontent, and we may be assured that he was encompassed by a train of indiscreet or perfidious followers who assiduously studied to inflame and who were perhaps instructed to betray the unguarded warmth of his resentment. An edict of Constantine, published about this time, manifestly indicates his real or affected suspicions that a secret conspiracy had been formed against his person and government. By all the allurements of honors and rewards, he invites informers of every degree to accuse without exception his magistrates or ministers, his friends or his most intimate favorites, protesting with a solemn asseveration that he himself will listen to the charge, that he himself will revenge his injuries, and concluding with a prayer which discovers some apprehension of danger that the providence of the Supreme Being may still continue to protect the safety of the Emperor and of the Empire. The informers who complied with so liberal an invitation were sufficiently versed in the arts of courts to select the friends and adherents of Crispus as the guilty persons. Nor is there any reason to distrust the veracity of the Emperor, who had promised an ample measure of revenge and punishment. The policy of Constantine maintained, however, the same appearances of regard and confidence towards a son whom he began to consider as his most irreconcilable enemy. Medals were struck with the customary vows for the long and auspicious reign of the young Caesar, and as the people, who were not admitted into the secrets of the palace, still loved his virtues and respected his dignity, a poet who solicits his recall from exile adores with equal devotion the majesty of the father and that of the son. The time was now arrived for celebrating the august ceremony of the 20th year of the